have this class and then the one on Sunday that will complete the quarter. And some of you may be going out to teach other classes, or some may be going into the foundations class. So we'd like to have you stay for the second half of this two-quarter class. Actually, it's been three quarters worth of study. We count the Gospel of Luke as our first class. But if you have to go out to teach, then we certainly understand you opting out. Okay, we looked at these slides on Sunday. We got through the first seven verses of Acts 19. Paul came to Ephesus. He fulfilled that earlier promise when they asked him to stay in chapter 18. He says, I cannot, but I will return if the Lord wills. And this chapter has him doing that. And we also noticed the rebaptism, if you want to phrase it that way, of these 12 men who had received John's baptism. But as we ended class with a discussion on Sunday, their baptism was not entirely valid. They had to be rebaptized or baptized again, this time in the name of the Lord. John's baptism was for repentance and remission of sins, but it was not in the Lord's name. And so when Paul explained to them that part of it, as you'll see there in verse 5, when they heard that, then they were baptized into the kingdom of God, into the Lord. So that's where we got to on Sunday. And also verses 6 and 7, Paul did impart to them some spiritual gifts. Verse 5. Okay, now we're at question 8, the last part of this particular section. Luke mentions Paul's ongoing activities, verses 8 through 10 of Acts 19 here in Ephesus. And following this episode of correctly baptizing these 12 men, where does Luke record that Paul goes? He's still in Ephesus, but where does he go now? All right, as his custom has always been, he will again enter the synagogue and do some more teaching. He'll try once again to reason with the Jews to help them understand their error, if you will, or their lack of serving God faithfully. So boldly teaching in the synagogue for how long does it say? 3 months. Okay, so here's a 3-month time span just listed in one verse. But again, what kind of opposition does Paul face? He's seen this kind of thing before. This is not new to Paul. Jews opposed him again. And so what does Paul do? Okay, he takes those who will listen to him. He withdraws. My version says that Paul withdrew himself away from them, that is, these opposing Jews. And not that he holed up somewhere, but where did he go that he could not be hindered in his teaching? All right, school of Tyrannus was the gentleman's name, or the man's name. How long was he there? Verse 10. 2 years. Okay. So he took away the disciples, and he began teaching daily in this school. So apparently Paul was able to acquire some accommodations, if you will. Public, this was a public place, public building, if you will. Worked it out with this man named Tyrannus. And Paul was able to teach there for 2 years, and he reasoned there, and that was a long stay there, if you will, in Ephesus. Now, it's at this juncture that we're going to work in the Galatian epistle. So turn to page 110 in your handouts. And like we did before with the Thessalonian letters, we'll leave the events here in Acts 19 and we'll talk about the Galatian letter. We feel like this is the best place to put the Galatian epistle. And we're going to admit up front that this is the letter of the journey, or of the letters that Paul wrote on his journeys. And there's six journey epistles that we're going to cover in the Acts class. Of the six that he wrote, this is the one that we know the least amount about in terms of a date and a place of writing. We cannot be as certain about this as the other five. So you may disagree with our reasons that we give, and that's certainly fine. one doesn't have to entirely know when Paul wrote Galatians and from where Paul wrote Galatians to understand this message. And that's, I would agree with that. But hopefully some of the reasons that we give will at least make biblical sense, and that's our aim anyway. Galatia, and I'm just looking through some of these bullet points on page 110 here. Galatia was a prominent place that Paul used on all his journeys. Of course, that's not a city, that's a region, if you remember looking at the maps. The first journey, 13 through 14, Paul and Barnabas went through Galatia. And then on the second journey, after he and Barnabas split ways, you remember, Barnabas went to Cyprus with John Mark, the island where Barnabas was from. But Paul chose Silas, and they went up through Cilicia, Paul's home, and then on into Galatia. And then, as we'll see on the third journey, where we were in chapter 18, also Paul has gone through Galatia. So every time Paul has traveled through that region, name me some Galatian cities off the top of your head. Lystra was one. Derbe, Iconium. All those cities Paul has been to previously. And so these would be those people that Paul is writing to in this letter. Those would be the Galatian Christians, a prominent place on his journey. Now, we're going to take the view that Paul wrote this letter after the so-called conference in Jerusalem, which is Acts chapter 15. And we take that view because if you look at the second chapter of Galatians, and when we were in Acts 15 not long ago, we made the connection to Galatians 2 and tied it in with Acts 15. And so there's a bit of a marker, if you will, as to when Galatians was written. I think it's after Acts 15 because Paul describes it at least to the first 10 verses of Galatians 2. So that kind of gives us a vague or a broad idea as to when this epistle was written. But I think one could also say that this letter was written before Paul made the decision to gather up the collection for the needy saints in Jerusalem. And that was a collection that was made or gathered on what journey? It had been the third journey. So if we say it's after Acts 15, which is before the second journey, but it's before the decision was made to gather the collection of the needy saints, which is on the third journey, so we're trying to narrow it down even more. And we say that because in 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, and Romans, you can find references to Paul gathering up this collection. And there is no such mention of this in Galatians, none whatsoever. So we take that to mean that decision had not yet been made, and Paul did not write that before that decision was made. As you'll see, and I think I put the reference on here. It's the first sub-bullet there on page 110. No mention of the collection is made, though some from Galatia participated. And that's Acts 20 and verse 4, which is the next chapter after where we are in Acts 19. You'll see there, as they're coming back with the gift, you'll see that Gaius of Derbe is mentioned as one of Paul's traveling companions, and they were bearing the gift already. They were bringing the gift back. So Gaius was involved in bringing that contribution back. But in terms of the Galatian letter, no such mention is made. So we take the view that this letter was written before that decision was made to gather that gift for the needy Christians there in the first century. Okay. Now in chapter 1 and verse 6 and verses 6 through 9, this oft-quoted passage where Paul talks about that neither apostles nor angels even have the right to change divine truth. He says, though we or an angel from heaven preach to you anything other than what we have preached, what did Paul say? Let him be accursed. If a whole legion of angels walked in this door tonight and said, well, what Paul wrote here is not so, they'd be wrong. Every last one of them would be wrong. Because God has spoken His Word. It's revealed and it's set. It's not changeable. So Paul was concerned about these Galatians. In verse 6 of Galatians 1, as you begin this major section here, verses 6 through 9, Paul says he was amazed about something. He was surprised. And really, it would probably be disappointingly surprised. Doug, what does he say? Yeah. You've already turned away. to another gospel which is not another. There is no other gospel. There's just one gospel. There's just one body of teaching. And Paul says, but I'm amazed. I'm shocked. I'm disappointed that you've already turned away. And then he goes in to say just how sure and secure it is that he taught while he was with them. I can't change it as an apostle. Not even an angel from heaven can change it. It's the Lord's message. And so Paul knew of the Galatians' apostasy. For him to say this in verse 6, I am amazed, he had to have been informed. He had to have known about their falling in some way. Now, I have here on the outline, page 110, I have two possibilities, but I thought of a third one after I sent out the material to you. So there's actually three possibilities, not just two. The first one is the Lord could have told him. I mean, that's a possibility. Paul was an inspired man. He was a man to whom the Lord revealed information. And so that certainly is plausible that God would have told Paul this. Now, we don't have any proof of that, but I can't say with certainty that God did not tell him. I can't say that. So Paul could have learned of this sad news by revelation. I don't think that's it personally, but I can't discount it totally. Now, the other two on the slides will match what you have in your material. The second possibility is that Paul could have seen this himself as he passed through Galatia. And again, if you've got your place marked back at chapter 18 of Acts, where the journey began, the third journey or the second journey ends in verse 22 of Acts 18, going back to Antioch. Then right in the next verse, verse 23, having spent some time there, he departed and passed successively through the Galatian and the Phrygian regions, strengthening the disciples. And so, one theory is, well, as Paul was going back through that region for the third time, okay? How long he stayed in Galatia? We don't know. It just says he passed through. How long did that take? That's anybody's guess. But as he passed through that region, he noticed some things. All right? He saw some things. He heard some things. He noticed some things that indicated these Galatians were already falling away and were guilty of apostasy. And so as he observed that, then you stay with the Acts record. He is leaving Galatia. And then sometime later and from some other place, then Paul wrote this letter back to the Christians saying what his concerns were about that. Now, that's a possibility. But I don't like that one either because, as you see the point there, under the second point under number one, that doesn't sound like the Paul that we know from Acts. And I offer to you Acts 17, 16 through 17 as an example. When Paul was in Athens, remember when he was waiting for Timothy and Silas to come to him? He's in Athens. How did Luke describe him? Okay, he saw the city wholly given over to idols. He just saw this rampant idolatry all over the place. And how did Luke describe his spirit? His demeanor. He was provoked, and Paul could not stand there and not say anything. That wasn't Paul's nature. When Paul saw something that needed to be addressed, he would address it. And so what if this was the possibility? What if, as Paul passed through the Galatian region on this third journey, what if he observed the Galatian Christians and their apostasy? What do you think more likely Paul would have done? I don't think he would have left. I think he would have stayed and dealt with it. He would have addressed it to these Christians because it was that much of a concern. So I can't say that it's not this. I don't see Paul doing that. So that takes us to the third option. This is the one that I like. But again, that's why we can't be entirely dogmatic about this. But to me, it fits. There are passages in the Acts record that I think this possibility can be easily folded into and it would harmonize. If the Lord didn't tell him and if Paul didn't see it himself, then I think the last option is somebody got word to Paul. He heard about it. Thus he says in Galatians 1 verse 6, I am amazed that you are so quickly turning or deserting him who called you by the grace of Christ for a different gospel. Paul heard about it. Somebody got word to Paul. And he's writing these Christians when he hears about it. Okay. Now, the only available information we've got for Paul to receive this news, that obviously means someone would have had to know where to find Paul. They didn't have phones. They didn't have internet. So they had to get him the news personally. The only information we've got is that in Acts 18, what had Paul promised? I will come back to Ephesus if the Lord wills. Right, that's all we've got. So, we take the view that the letter was written from Ephesus. How long was he in Ephesus? We just read Acts 19 and verse 10. Well, we know it's not just 2 years. Over 2 years. Because just for the moment, look in Acts 20. Now, we're jumping ahead just for a minute. But look in Acts 20 when he's addressing the Ephesian elders at Miletus. Okay, Acts 20. And look with me at verse 31. What did Paul say he did? He warned them night and day for how long? 3 years. He was in Ephesus for 3 years. Okay? Not just two. He was in Tyrannus' school for 2 years. But obviously there's another year that the Acts record doesn't give us information. But, well, I'm sorry, the Acts record does tell us, but not when he's there in Ephesus. It's after when he's talking with those elders at another place. So for 3 years, Paul was in Ephesus. Plenty of time to receive information from whoever got him the news about the Galatian Christians and for Paul to write a letter by inspiration and send it off to the churches of Galatia. Now, I can't say that's definite. Can't say it, but to me it fits. Now, you may take a differing view, and that's fine. Some take an earlier date or a later date than this, and those are all okay. But that's the view I'm going to go with in our material. Paul wrote the letter from Ephesus. And we stick it right in here at Acts 19 and at verse 10 when he's in the school of Tyrannus for 2 years. That's where I plug the Galatian letter. Okay. Now, there's a point we just made that it came during the 3 years that he was in Ephesus. Okay. The letter is not addressed to those who were troubling these Christians. It was addressed to the Galatians for tolerating and receiving this error that was being taught. Noticeably absent is at the start of Paul's letters, usually he says something like, I thank God for you, or I thank my God upon every remembrance of you, quoting, say, Philippians and the Corinthian letters and Thessalonian Christians. You don't see any kind of introductory thankful greeting. What's Paul get right to? He gets right to it. This is a warning. This epistle is a warning. For example, in chapter 5, verses 2 through 3, let's look at that real quickly. Galatians 5, 2 through 3, just to kind of get an idea of the flavor of this letter, it's a warning. Freddie, read for us Galatians 5, verses 2 through 3, please. All right, so these Judaizing teachers were telling these Christians. Now, again, this is after that conference in Jerusalem. And the issue back there in Acts 15 was what? Circumcision. These Gentile Christians, they must be circumcised to be saved. Well, remember, the apostles and the elders wrote that letter that was supposed to have solved it. But apparently, in the minds of some, it was not solved. So they come along later with this teaching. And not only was it bad enough that these men were teaching this error, but what was even worse? The Galatian Christians were accepting it and tolerating it and even believing it. Yes. That's right. The letter from Acts 15 was carried to the churches in Galatia. That is correct. And so now here comes some Judaizing teachers who are trying once again to bring the Gentiles under the law. And so Paul just gives the warning that Freddie just read. Look, if you're going to receive circumcision, then all that Jesus did for you is what? Nothing. And besides that, if you keep this one aspect of the law, that is circumcision, what else you got to do? You got to keep all of it. You can't pick and choose. It's not a buffet line. You got to take all of it. And there's lots of problems with that kind of thinking. One more quick warning. Chapter 6, verses 12 through 13. All right. Wayne, read for us Galatians 6, 12 through 13, please. Okay. So particularly verse 13, Paul is saying, now these who are teaching you this, what did Paul know about them? They don't even keep the law. So why were they trying to compel these Galatians? They just wanted to boast in your flesh. Just kind of like putting notches in a gun belt. Just want to have more people line up behind them. They don't care about you. They don't even keep the law. They're hypocrites. Okay, so Paul was giving warning after warning in this letter. And we'll go through it in a few minutes to see exactly what the main message was. But it is a warning. Okay, the letter is not addressed to these teachers. It's addressed to these Galatian Christians who were contemplating, maybe even already starting to receive this false teaching. And Paul warns them for that reason. Okay. Well, let's look at the epistle itself. And now we come to the outline that's on it's on page 111. Yes, sir, go ahead. About 10 years worth? Yes. 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 10-year period of time. They should have known better. And they were receiving this teaching. That tells you something about them. It also tells you what about brethren, just because you've been in the kingdom for some time, you can't slack off. You've got to always be on your guard. All of us do. You can't coast, put it on autopilot or put it on cruise control and just kind of roll for a while. You've got to always watch. Always got to be watchful. Okay. Yes. He admonished the Ephesian elders when he was there with them. That's right. Okay. The Galatian letter will break down into two chapter sections. The first two chapters is the first section, then chapters 3 and 4, and then chapters 5 and 6. That's how an easy way for it to be outlined. And the first section, this is top of page 111 now, Paul defends his right as an apostle to teach and to speak to them on this matter. Usually, and we'll see this even more so in the Second Corinthian letter, the Judaizing teachers who always opposed Paul always tried to counteract what he taught by attacking his apostleship. All right? Whether they attacked him personally, his character, his physical stature, or they attacked his credibility in terms of speaking as an apostle. Oh, after all, he wasn't one of the original 12. All right, they just kind of tried to dismiss all these things. So in these first two chapters, Paul defends his right to speak. And he proves his right as an apostle to preach. Now, verses 6 through 10, the familiar verses. Paul he's amazed that they've already left, that they have so soon departed to another gospel, which is not another. But though we are an angel from heaven, preach any other gospel to you other than what we have preached, let him be accursed. And Paul says, as I said before, so I now say again. And he repeats that very stern warning there in verse 9. Let him be accursed if we preach anything else. Okay. Now, some of the proof that Paul gives that he has the right to speak as an apostle. No one, not even apostle or angel, has the right to change the gospel. And here Paul begins in verse 11 of chapter 1 through the end of chapter 2. He gives reason after reason of his right to preach and to speak boldly as an apostle. Look in verses 11 through 16 of chapter 1. The first reason he gives is Paul goes back and talks somewhat about his lifestyle before he was converted. You see that, verse 11. For I would have you know, brethren, that the gospel which was preached by me is not according to man. We didn't get this out of somebody's head. For I neither received it from man, nor was I taught it. But I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ. For you have heard of my former manner of life in Judaism. What kind of man was Paul before he was converted. Now, remember from the Acts record. That's right. He tried his level best to destroy the church. So we know this wasn't from man. Paul didn't dream this up. Paul didn't concoct this or make this up. He says, I used to be on the other side. And now you know what I'm preaching. That ought to tell you. I didn't make this up. This does not come from the mind of man. He mentions that in verses 13 and 14. Verse 15, He who has set me apart even from my mother's womb has called me through His grace, was pleased to reveal His Son in me, that I might preach Him among the Gentiles. And he says that also at that time, verse 16, I did not immediately consult with flesh and blood. I didn't go somewhere and sit at the feet of the apostles and have them school me and teach me all this. Paul didn't have to do that. He was inspired just like they were. So there's the first reason. Through verse 16, now verse 17, he was not instructed, but he was inspired. That's all the way down through verse 20. He mentions a couple of things. Verse 17, I did not go to Jerusalem to those who were apostles before me, but after he was converted. And remember, the story is in Acts chapter 9. But Acts 9 does not mention what Galatians 1:17 tells us. When Paul was converted, based on Galatians 1:17, what did he do that Acts 9 doesn't record? He went into Arabia. For how long? We don't know. But then he came back to Damascus, where he was. And then, verse 18, what was the time lapse? 3 years, where did he go? He went to Jerusalem. That is later on in Acts chapter 9. So these bits of information right here kind of get plugged in or tucked into the account in Acts 9 that Luke doesn't write for us there. But Paul says, I didn't go anywhere and have somebody sit me down and say, all right, now, Paul, here's the story. You're going to be a preacher, so you need to know what's going on. Paul says, I didn't have that done. I was not taught by any man. I got this by revelation, just like the apostles who were before me did. They got it the same way that I got it. All right? He also mentions that his efforts in Damascus and Arabia, his early preaching efforts, show that the message was not from him. He did not originate this. Then in chapter 2, 1 through 10, again, what we're calling the Jerusalem Conference, that proves that Paul had a right to speak as an apostle. Remember in Acts 15, we can go back there real quickly, remember how the disagreement was described when those Judaizing teachers came? Acts 15 and it's verse 2. What kind of discussion or debate did Paul and Barnabas have with them? It says, not a little one. It means it was a big one. It was a major one. Well, again, see, Paul isn't taking their side. Paul is taking the side of truth in this. So again, that was indicative of Paul's role as an apostle and his right to speak and teach in such a way. So his efforts at the conference indicated that his message was not from man, but it was from God. Then after the conference is over, and as Freddie mentioned a few moments ago, and when the elders and apostles wrote that letter and decided, remember, as we studied, it was James came up with the idea that we send these churches, or these Christians, the letter. And so they wrote it all out, and the apostles began to carry it, two of which were Paul and Barnabas. They go back to Antioch. This is Acts 15. This is before Paul and Barnabas, of course, split, before the second journey. Again, Luke doesn't record this for us, but in Galatians 2, who came to Antioch? Verse 11. Peter came to Antioch. This was before Paul and Barnabas split. So Peter comes to Antioch. And what happened in Antioch with Peter? Pardon? All right, Peter became a hypocrite. It says, before certain men from James came, that would have been the James up in Jerusalem, how about Peter's interaction with the Gentiles before that happened? No problem. He interacted with them. But when those men from James came, what did Peter do? He withdrew. Oh, we can't have that now. See, I've got an image to protect here. And so what did Paul do? Galatians 2. Took Peter right in the public, right to his face, and chided him and rebuked him for that. So again, only an apostle would do that. Yes, Peter had preached at Caesarea to Cornelius, the first Gentile convert. And that's what makes Peter's actions in Galatians 2 so disappointing. He was the first one to preach to Gentiles, and here he's acting like this. And so, did Paul feel any bit inferior to the 12 original apostles? Not a bit. He would say what had to be said, and he rebuked Peter to his face. In fact, I think again it says, if we look at the phrase in Galatians 2, verse 14, I said to Cephas or Peter, in the presence of all. He didn't take them aside, like we studied Sunday with Priscilla and Aquila, taking Apollos aside. That wasn't a chiding. That was just some instruction. This is a rebuke. Others were carried away. Absolutely. And that had to be done before them so that they would know what they had sided up with in terms of with Peter was the wrong choice to make. I know. Barnabas got carried away. That had to be disappointing to Paul. Okay. So these are the proofs, if you will, that shows Paul is a legitimate apostle. Every bit as much an apostle as the original 12. He did not feel inferior. They didn't teach him. He got his information just like they got theirs. And so Paul has the right to address these Galatian Christians on that level. His message was not from men, but it was from God directly, just like the other 12. That's what he spends the first two chapters talking about. Okay? Now, he gets to the warning. All right, chapter 3 and 4. And Paul tells them, looking at the heading here on page 111, that these spiritual blessings that are for Christians come to you or are for you because of God's promise and not because of what? Works of law, which would have been what these Judaizing teachers would be espousing. Look, Gentiles, you want to be right with God? You've got to keep the law. Namely, you've got to be circumcised just like us. That was a sign of the covenant. That's what you've got to do. See, that's a work of the law. And Paul's saying, no, that's not how you're right with God anymore. It's through promise. Yes, that's right, Tom. They're trying to have these Christians circumcised. Circumcision profits you nothing. If you receive the law, you are falling from grace, falling away from Christ if you adopt that kind of a system or that kind of a mindset. All right. So let's look at these main points. All right, chapter 3. And I want you to notice, even here in the third chapter, the Holy Spirit, really, I shouldn't just say Paul. The Holy Spirit's choice of who is used in the text is not by accident. It's not even by coincidence. This is inspiration. You want to be right with God, justification, which, by the way, that word means what? To be justified meant what? It's a legal term. It means to be free of guilt. Not guilty. Innocent. Okay. To be innocent before God, Paul says, is on the basis of faith in God, not on the basis of a law system. And who does he give as an example? Abraham. Now, what would that have meant to the Judaizing teachers? This is the name Abraham. Oh, he's up there. With Moses, Abraham, they're the big names in Judaism. Okay? Father Abraham, the father of the nation of Israel. But Paul says, look, Abraham wasn't even justified before God on the basis of works. Now, this is a lot similar, say, to Romans chapter 4. A lot of similarities between this chapter and this book and some of the teachings in Romans. Particularly Romans 4. It says that if Abraham was justified before God, he has whereof the glory in terms of his works, but not before God, because God knows better. He wasn't justified on the basis of works either. To have the kind of faith possessed by Abraham. And then Paul goes on to say in verses 15 through 29, actually, if you want to be truthful about it, what about the promises that he's talking about? Which came first, the law or the promises? What's Paul say? Promises came first. All right? Genesis 12. We know the Bible story. God made those promises. When he said to him, get up from the Ur of the Chaldees and go to a land that I'll show you. I'll give it to you as an inheritance. I'll make of you a great nation. Those were promises to Abraham that would have been specifically for the Jews. The land promise and the seed, or the nation promise, the family. Okay. But then in verse 3, and in thy seed shall all families of the earth, and in thy seed shall all nations or families of the earth be blessed. That's for everybody. Now, where was the law at that point? It was in the mind of God. That's where it was. Moses wasn't even alive yet to be the mediator for that law. So the promises predate the law, Paul says. So God always had it in mind to justify man on the basis of promise, not on the basis of law. And law was added, verse 19, then Paul asks the question in this discussion. Of course, I know I'm skipping around quite a bit just to get the general gist of the letter. So then if he's emphasizing promises, okay. Well, did Paul know that there was a law? Well, of course he did. So he asked the question that's begged. Okay, why the law then? If God always managed or wanted man to be justified on the basis of promise, then why did he give the law? Verse 19, what's the answer? The law was added because of transgression. Well, the law was what made sin apparent. The law set the bar, if you will, and showed what was inacceptable behavior. And law also would show the Jew, and particularly I think in mind here, these Judaizing teachers, the legalistically minded Jew who tried to live by the law. Did God ever intend for the law to be the basis for man to be justified, even in the days of the Old Testament? No. Because as you'll see in Galatians 3 and verse 24 and so forth, of course, who was coming eventually? Well, the Messiah was coming. God always had that in mind. But to the legally minded Jew, the law was added because of transgression, but the law would also show man's need for what? That the law could not give. You break the law, all right? Once you violate even one statute of the law, you are forever a lawbreaker. You're condemned. And the law of Moses is an example of this, or any law system, just on the basis of being a law system, where's the provision for grace and mercy? It's not there. You're condemned. You had it. So the law was added to show what sin is and to also help man see his need for mercy, which, of course, will be found in who? Christ. Not in the law, but in Christ. So, if a man's going to justify it on the basis of law, what's he got to do? How many times can he falter? Not one time. He's got to get it right all the time. Yes, and in fact, if you look on page 112, this is question 2. We'll go ahead and just answer this since we're right here in chapter 3. I've asked you in Galatians 3 and verse 10, in what sense is the law a curse? Paul says it's a curse. For as many as are of the works of the law, that is, who take this mindset that these teachers are telling you, as many as have that mindset are under a curse. Well, what's the curse? Look at the quotation. Galatians 3, verse 10. Are under a curse, for it is written, cursed is everyone who does not abide by all, underline the word all things written in the book of the law to do them. You place yourself under a curse if you adopt this mindset to justify yourself based upon your good works. You can't measure up. You will fail. Miserably fail. And that's not what God had in mind for you. So he's telling the Galatian Christians, you cannot listen to this teaching. You're going back to an inferior system. You're going back to a system that you can't even win at spiritually. You'll lose. You will not be justified. You'll be condemned. And so he says in verse 13, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law, having become a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone who hangs upon a tree. Okay. We will stop right here. And we're picking up on Sunday, the Lord willing, middle of the page here, page 111 in this second section. And we'll do our best to complete the Galatian epistle on Sunday. just give it a quick overview, quick review there, if you will. Thank you all for your good comments and participation tonight.